Hey everybody, my name is Dan and I'm an alcoholic. I've been in Georgia since 1968. I appreciate the opportunity of getting to share tonight what it was like and what this program has done for me today. My sobriety date is February 9th, 1986. I never will forget that last drunk. I was going from place to place with people I didn't know. I was just like in and out of blackouts and ended up at this bar like at 4 in the morning. I didn't even have my car at that time. I mean, I left it somewhere. I left it at a bar. I was walking out and I'm thinking, I don't even know where I am. I didn't really know Atlanta very well because I had the geographical cure thinking if I could just get away from all these people, I wouldn't have to I wouldn't have to drink. It's all these people, all these responsibilities that I have. And I married a man with 5 kids. God, I thought, well, that's enough to make you drink. And I stayed drunk. In fact, I got drunk before I said the vows. That's just how insane I was. I did get a ride back from this man. I couldn't tell you what his face looked like or anything, and just how insane it is to even go with people you don't know. I mean, sober, I would never do anything like that. And when I woke up, I thought, oh my gosh, I just cannot do this anymore. I don't know what I need to do, but I knew I needed something. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I called information for the number to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was like squalling. And the poor operator probably thought, oh my goodness, this girl's dying. That's what I felt like, too. She said, which one would you like? And I said, well, it really doesn't matter at this point. And I guess what happened was that I got the number to central office in Atlanta, and then they got the message over to the Atlanta Biscayne Room, and that is when the people came out and shared their experience, strengths, and hope. But I was real sick, and I was just shaking. I mean, and they even went to an eating meeting that night, and I was like, oh my God, no. But I didn't eat because I knew. Well, what was going to happen if I did? And, after that meeting, it was a meeting about God, and, there was this man that was talking, and he was wondering, and I guess it may have been further along in recovery, but it didn't really matter to me, because I already had talked to these other people, and they made me feel welcome, and I was still a little bit leery of why they would welcome me, but this man was speaking, and he was speaking about whether he should give his life more to Alcoholics Anonymous or to the church. And it just went on and on about that. But the unity is what I felt. I felt like, well, he talked about a lot about that, but he also talked about the unity in the rooms. And I felt that. I felt like I belonged somewhere. I didn't know what it was about or what it was going to be. I guess what I really thought when they finally took me to the Atlanta Biscayne Room, because they took me to the meeting first, I thought it was just going to be a lot of people just laying around on the couch and hungover and, you know, not bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And, I walked in, and it was like everybody looked better than I did. I mean, I felt like I looked Well, you know, I was still hungover and very sick, and I wasn't thinking clearly. And the first thing, one of the ladies, the old timer, she said, "I want to tell you this because you might need this. Go and I want to show you where the restroom is." And so she knew I was going to need that restroom. And I met that toilet, I thought, for the last time. And it was about halfway through the night meeting. But the one thing they shared, someone shared, Chris shared that to remember that you're loved, you're wanted, and you're needed. And you know, by the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my family, I just had not kept in touch with them. I mean, my father would read the newspaper and the obituaries to see if there was some white girl around 28 years old at the time, or for as long as I drank, and to see if there was one identified in case it was me, you know. And, you know, I'm not proud of that. That's just, and I didn't have any care. I remember going out. I'd been out all over the place. I always felt there was a party somewhere else. It just wasn't where I was at. So I kind of had that rabbit fever, you know, where you just hop along, keep going and finding a party, which the party was always somewhere else. So that's why I couldn't stay in one place very long, because they would catch on to that I was a wino. I remember one time going into this old bar, and I mean, I thought they were really bad off. You know, the reason I went there is because they all stayed drunk real bad, and I thought, well, you know, I don't drink as bad as that. So I'll go in there. Well, the most embarrassing thing happened one night when I came in there, and it was just another excuse to drink, but I think it was the bartender that said, "Here comes that old wino again." Because I was bad. I mean, I don't know what it was about, liquor, but it made me cry. It made me have horrible nightmares, you know, real, and the type that you have when you're asleep. The whole thing was a nightmare. And I thought I was keeping it up. I was married, and I had a business. I had a hair salon, and it was successful. And I had periods of time when I would try to control it, you know, and I couldn't. And stop. I'm sorry. So that control kind of thing. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to go to church. You know, that would be one thing I would do. And that might work for a little while, but ultimately I went back to the drink. There was a point in time when alcohol did work. And I think I always tried to get back that euphoria, feeling that I'm not different. I fit in. You know, I always felt different. And I always thought that if my parents, they just really felt bad, and I had seen my father beating my mother in the head, you know, and then her scratching, and it's just like a dog and cat fight. And he would get us out in the middle of the night and go looking for her and beat her head and get her in the car, and it was just so chaotic. I remember being outside and playing, and them riding by the car, my mother screaming out. I was like, just a kid, but I was so embarrassed. But I just always thought, if I could be good enough for them, maybe they wouldn't have to do that. I always thought it was somehow my fault. I took responsibility for it. I didn't know it wasn't my fault. But, so they drank, and I just thought, well, at 13, I had my first drink. It was just for that one day, but when everybody was out, and I had my friend over, we got into the liquor cabinet and got into the pills, you know, and I didn't even know what I was taking. It's a wonder I didn't kill myself. And the girl, I don't know if she took anything. I was so busy doing my thing, you know. And so about when I was working at McDonald's, and I met this girl named Bobby, and we began to be best friends, and we were bar hopping together, and she said they needed a shampoo girl over to the Cut and Curl at the time. She said, would you like to do that? And I said, no, I don't think I know how to do that. She said, well, we'll teach you. I didn't really like flipping burgers and all that, you know. Well, that was the real turning point of alcohol beginning to take on uncontrolled, you know, I couldn't control it, or I would try to get back, you know, just always trying, and I tried and tried and tried. I was 28 when I came into the program, and I felt like I was crawling on my knees, and I swear I would have done anything not to feel the way that I felt. And I'm so thankful that Biscayne Room was there, because they took me under the wing. I mean, I couldn't put two sentences together. People would look. I remember this guy named Jerry. He said that he's on to heaven too. So many people I've seen die sober, some not sober, but mostly I've seen people that were close to me that went on to the great AA meeting in heaven, I'm sure. But he said, I don't know what we're going to do about Jan. She really is mixed up. And I mean, her eyes, they just, one's going one way and one's going the other. And I'm like, when he said that, I overheard him, and I said, I didn't know anybody could see that. I felt it, but I didn't know everybody was really seeing. I thought it was just my imagination. Oh, and he thought that was funny. And he said, well, we'll just have to get her a trade or something where she's doing factory work or something, just so she just puts a part on one at a time, every time, all day long for 8 hours. That's probably the best she'll be able to do. But we'll get her going. Needless to say, I was educated, but I didn't sound educated, and I'm certainly not a rocket scientist by any means, but I did know how to function after I got a few days under my belt, you know. I did admit in one of the meetings that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable. And there was a sense of relief, and I knew that. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to stick with it, because, you know, I made those before. And so, but people kept telling me, keep coming back, you know, and I kept coming back, and little by little, insanity began to take on its course, and I began to feel better, and I felt like my thoughts were, my thoughts were being of, like, sentences instead of words, you know. I could, like, think something and go, oh, yeah, that makes sense, you know, or hear somebody and, not hear all of it when I was thirsty, but I began to hear all of what they had to say, not just parts of it where I could rattle my head enough to hear it. I mean, I was one sick puppy. And I remember calling my father, and I told him, I said, you know, I just want to tell you, because I hadn't talked to him in a while, I wanted to tell him that I decided to go to AA. And he said, it's about the time that you did something about your problem. You know, and any other time, if somebody had said that to me, I would have done that to be an excuse to go out and drink again. My stepmother, I think right before I came into these rooms, I said, my life is so chaotic. And she says, Jane, you're living in constant chaos. You are chaos. And, you know, of course, that time I did take it and drink over it. You know, whatever. You know, I had to. They were just excuses to be oblivious and didn't care. Didn't have to feel like I belonged anywhere. Didn't have to feel like I was different. I just didn't have any feelings at all toward the end of my drinking. And I didn't have a care in the world but me. But I always, after that, I came to the Biscayne Room, and they had like this coffee club at the Biscayne Room. The room was open till like 12 every night, and it opened like at 7:30. And so I would go, and they didn't have a meeting, but they just sit there and they talk and everything, and I just go there every day. The first 3 days I sat there, they had this 72-hour recovery program where all of these women would take their time and sit with you, you know, talk to you, and stay there at that room. But, oh, no, I wasn't going to do that. I'd already been in some places like that where the door didn't unlock when you wanted it to, and I didn't want to be stuck anywhere. That was not really a good idea. I should have taken them up on it because it would have been a lot easier. But even still, I would come. I said, I promise I'll come back in the morning, and I'm going to be here, and I'm stay here all day. And sure enough, I didn't sleep any that night, but I did get up, and I went to that room. I don't think I slept for a few days after coming into that room. I was just so, I don't know, I just couldn't. And I just kept hearing people laughing at that coffee club thing, and they were old timers, and they were just talking about all these things I've just shared, and I couldn't understand why they were laughing. I had just went through a living friggin' nightmare, and they're laughing about it. And so one of the girls that had come to my apartment came in after she got off work and said, "How are you doing, Jane?" I said, "I'm okay, but these people here, they're just laughing at these horrible things that I just went through. I can't understand that. It wasn't funny to me." And she said, "Well, don't let it bother you, because you know you're getting better when you start laughing yourself." And I just couldn't imagine that. And the group carried me for a long time as far as finding the higher power greater than myself. I began to believe these people knew what they were doing. And I kept coming back, and I did start laughing. You know, all of a sudden, I wasn't unique anymore. You know, my stories were just, maybe they had a different story, it all came down to the same thing, you know, and I did start laughing at it. But I still had a hard time wondering, is this really going to work? But I know today that it really does work. It really, if I put get myself out of the way and let this higher power help me stay sober one day at a time, that I might be able to make it. I began after a while believing I might. And then I began to believe we can. And that's when I realized that I didn't have to do this thing alone. And that was, they kept talking about these steps. And I was like, what steps? You know, they had these huge things on the walls in this game room, had the 12 steps up there, and they had the 12 and 12 up there, the traditions. And I didn't even see them. And I don't know what. I didn't hear anything in the meetings. I don't know what. I don't remember hearing anything. But I knew I was in the right place, and that's all that really mattered. Because I was at least with people that had my background, you know, like, I was kind of embarrassed about it. And I didn't do good things when I was, you know, one of the things that alcoholics have is the problem with relationships, you know. And I went through a lot of them. I was always, someone shared the other night that they was looking for love in all the wrong places. That is exactly what I was doing. I always wanted to be loved and wanted and needed. And that lady, Chris, said that in the meeting. I couldn't believe somebody had said that, because that's exactly what I was wanting. Well, that made me want to come back, you know, and I felt like, well, she really meant that. And one morning when I went to the Biscayne Room, Maggie was my sponsor. She's another one that's gone up to the great heavens of AA. She started the Atlanta Biscayne Room, and another lady named Mary, and they had, Maggie had one at first in Florida, and then her job with the phone company took her up here, so to Atlanta, and so she opened Biscayne Room here. She told me, she said, we've got a lady in there in that room we call the 72-hour room where we had people stay and the people in the room would stay with them. The men would stay with the men and the women would stay with the women. She said, I want you to go in there and talk to her. I said, baby, I don't know anything to say. I don't know what to say. She said, Jane, have you had a drink today? And I said, no, ma'am. Then you go in there and you share. You haven't had a drink today. And I went in there and I was like, oh, gosh, I know she's making me do the wrong thing. But that was the beginning of giving back. I walked in there and I had maybe 4 days of sobriety. Not picking up a drink, and that in itself is a miracle for this alcoholic at that time. And I went in there and I told her who it was, and I just kind of chit-chatted with her and told her a little bit about what I was like, and that I thought I had found the right place to be, and that I was going to hang out here for a while. And she started crying and felt, and she was telling me about her story. And after a while, she wanted to take a nap, and that was fine. And so I went back out. And Maggie said, well, how did it go? And I said, well, I just went in there and told her what you told me to tell her. And I hadn't had a drink and told her a little bit about myself and my past. And she shared. And I don't know if she helped or not. She says, did you stay sober? I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, well, then that's what it's all about. you've got another notch in your belt. And that was when I realized that there was lots of opportunities, being that it was a clubhouse. We got a lot of calls from the central office to do 12-step work, and getting out of self and beginning to be a little less self, being selfless, not selfish, because, you know, when you're working with another alcoholic, it's real hard to be into yourself. And then I met a girl named Kathy. She came in when I had about 6 months of sobriety. And by then, you know, I started to feel a little more worthy every day, you know, and started feeling like I was in the right place. And I had found the God of my understanding. A lot of people get really freaked out about the thing about God. But really, in all of our steps, except for the first step, talks about a higher power, God. Just the first step says we became powerless over alcohol, and that our lives are becoming unmanageable. The rest is about God. And then here in the big book, you read the stories of Bill Wilson and Bob. They talked about it would take a spiritual experience to truly recover from alcoholism, but not to get too cocky to think that recovery, you recovered, because it says a story in there about a man who did that. He had his house, he had his wife back, he had money in his pocket, and he was just boasting all about that. And the next thing you know, he's drunk. So I learned from a lot of people sharing that I need to take this very seriously and not forget where I came from. And Maggie said to me, "Dan, if you ever forget your last drunk, if you forget, you probably never will. You probably drink again." And I was like, oh my gosh. So I really, I just kept thinking about it. I wake up every morning and think, okay, that's what it was like, you know, okay. Every time I would come into something that would be a situation where I might have drank, I would remember what she said, and I thought, I don't want to go back there, you know, I don't want to do that again. And so that's that was a real point, and I was grateful that she shared that with me, and she wasn't trying to scare me. It was just the truth. A lot of truth said in these meetings, and a lot of them aren't. They're hard, you know. They might hurt your feelings, because we've still got some character defects, like very sensitive, very fearful, anger. I remember going into a meeting one time, and they were talking about character defects. And he went around the room asking everybody, did they have a character defect? And he got to me, and I said, no, I don't have any character defects. He said, well, keep coming back. Just keep coming back. And later on, when I thought about what I said, I said, Lord knows I've got more defects of character than I have character at all. So anyway, I began to understand that this fourth step to me, I was making such a big deal about it. Because that's the way I was. I was just always making everything a mountain out of a molehill. It's about just putting down what happened and what my resentments were. Don't tell me to do anything. You can just write them down. I didn't have to go anywhere with them. And I didn't have to write a book about it. I wrote what I knew and did a fifth step with my sponsor. They say you don't have to use your sponsor. You can go to the monastery, talk to a priest, a monk, I mean, your preacher, your anybody that you feel will be honest with you. And that's the key, is when taking what you're saying and helping you to put it in perspective and where we were wrong. After we take that inventory, Maggie said, okay, now you put your name at the top of the list. That's because this is your inventory. You've taken all these people's inventory, but really it's all your problem. I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, I thought all these other people had harmed me. Now, I had amends to make to all those people, but I didn't become willing at that point. It took going on and doing the sex and getting a little deeper into the knowing what the character defects were and how they would affect my sobriety. And God all the time was holding my hand in the group to try to do the steps the best that I could with the knowledge that I had. And the more I keep coming back, the more I pick up in the meetings and the more I identify with the people. I see a lot more similarities nowadays than I do differences. And that's very important. If there's something you can feel connected with them, feel the similarity, hold to that, you know. If there's something you don't like in a meeting, don't worry about it. Leave it. You don't have to take it. But in the end, I always end up, whatever somebody said and I didn't like it and I left it at the room, I ended up taking it before it was over. Because it all began to, the pieces of the puzzle, the pieces of life started to be put together. And it's like an old penny. And they shine it up and they make it all new. And I felt like that's what AA has done for me. It's taken a penny and make it all shiny and new. And it allows me to be with the main stream of life. And I can be at work and I can do my work and I can do it better than I did when I was drunk or hungover. I mean, some days I would go and work and I know I reeked of alcohol because I didn't even shower and I would have the same clothes on. I mean, it was disgusting. But I don't have to do that today. And I have made amends and I'm not perfect and I still have some character defects that I need to work on. And it's been lately that a couple have really kind of resurfaced as the being more sensitive and having life on my shoulders, you know, and very quick to make, just to debate something, and I'm like, this is not me. And so I'm asking God to lead me in the right direction, to create that, just take that character defects and take them away because I don't like the way it makes me feel. The sobriety life has always been better than the days I was drinking, but they're not always easy. And I had lots of turning points in it. You know, and every time I would always be on my knees asking God for help and talking to other recoveries and asking them for help. And things did turn around because I trusted the God of my understanding, and I trusted the people, and that was a big step in recovery for me, to know that I didn't have to do this by myself, that I had a lot of support in rooms like this. I just felt, I'm sorry, my dog. Anyway, so, yeah, I was saying that, you know, they're much better than they were. Any day, bad day sober is better than any worst day of my drinking, if you know what I mean. And I did get married in Alcoholics Anonymous after a while. I met somebody, and we have been together for 22 years. We just celebrated our 22nd year of marriage. I think we lived in San Antonio. I don't know. I can't remember, but I'm kind of confused about that at the moment. It would come to me. But anyway, it's really not. It's a great thing, and it was a great thing because he had time and I had time. But I know that if we put a fifth of Jack Daniels on that kitchen table and my husband will start drinking it, that marriage will go down in a New York minute. And I know that. And we both know it. And we have made, before we made our vows, it was one we had, and if you drink, you have to leave. If I drink, I have to leave. And we meant it. And so far, in this 24 hours, we haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink. I think it's a constant, to me, it's like working the steps becomes so much a part of your life that you just sort of automatically do it. Because you've studied them, you've been here, and you build some time into it, and it begins to be a part of life. It begins to be a part of life, and we begin to be a part of the real world outside these rooms, and we can function by the grace of God, and having that trust in God, and feeling strong, and it says in the Big Book, we don't have to apologize for our faith in God. The people that talk about not believing, they're the ones missing. But I don't have to defend my God. I know it's true. He is true to me, and He is in my heart. But I know in my first recovery that actually I didn't have a problem with God. It really didn't matter what you guys did. I just wanted to have what you had, and I would do anything it took to get it. I was just beaten down so far, and it was so freely given, and it was just, you know, explained to me thousands of times till I got it, you know, or got that part, and then remind me again if I forgot it, you know. And it's still that way, you know. I still have problems in this world. It's not, there was a lady I knew, and she wasn't in AA. It was just playground of, she was just a normal person. Believe it or not, we can hear a lot from everyone if we really have the presence of God in our mind and in our heart. We will see what we're supposed to see and that God puts in front of us, just having that awareness of God. And she said, you know, none of us are going to have a problem-free life until we're 6 foot under. Well, that was like a light bulb going off. I thought, well, you know, that's probably about right. And I've had more good days in recovery, but I have had the really hard ones, and I've lost my sponsor, but I still feel she is in my heart, and she still talks to me. I hear her voice a lot of times. I face things that I have to face, and I think, what would she say? What would she tell me? And she would tell me, and I would do what she would do. It's still stuck. She was gone, but she was still there. And I know anybody that's lost their sponsor knows exactly what I'm talking about. We had a conference meeting, in Coleman, Alabama. It was at the Coleman, Monastery, and, I met a lot of the monks. I never knew they did anything but pray. I thought that. But they don't. They really are funny, and they laugh, and they make bread, and they did lots of things in the community. They pray a lot too. But Father Henry was like the big bishop, you know, arch, whatever. I'm not Catholic, and I don't want to display that at all because I just don't know the lingo. But I got to know Father Hillary, and he was one of us. And that's how we ended up up there. And he said he grew up at Coleman, Alabama. And he said, if you haven't had, if you haven't tasted the Coleman, Alabama blackberry wine, you'll just have to wait till you get to heaven, because he's sure that it'll be there, because he had walked high in the fields when he was drinking that stuff. It just did things to him that just made him blow away, you know. It was just, he was just hilarious. And we also went to Florida every year. Some of us would go, we have a little hotel that Maggie's daughter used to own, and we would all go there. And Maggie's daughter passed away, so but her name stood on that building for a long time, and we would just have meetings around the beach, and it was just such a time of peace and joy and fellowship and getting to know people in ways you never thought you could, you know. You thought you knew them when you were in meetings, but get off like that. Oh, it's in that on the beaches, you know, having meetings, having and staying up drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes, and just play, or even just playing, scrappy with a guy that, yeah, kind of knew, you know, but, you know, nothing to it other than a friend. And I thought that was the nice thing. We just kind of shared, you know, just chit-chat. It's those little things that really made me feel more and more comfortable in being part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met a friend early in my, I'm kind of back, going back and forth, and I'm sorry about that, but I just, that's the way I do. I met a lady that came in, her name is Kathy, and she's still one of my very best friends. Because she calls, and right now, and she said, I just wanted you to know I love you, and I was thinking about you, and I want to know how you're doing. We would stay at the Biscayne Room on Sundays, and we would just sit by the phone hoping that a call would come in. We'd go do this 12-step, and we've been on this really 12-step call, and this lady was really, she was still drinking. And I remember what Maggie said, if you ever encounter something like that, you tell your story, and you get up and you leave. And I started telling my story. Kathy thought I knew everything. I had 6 months, and she just had, she had been in a 90-day program or some 30 days, something like that. I don't know anything. And she probably, we were probably right at the same level, because she seemed pretty smart, and I was really pretty dumb to the way I thought things. Anyway, but we're going out back to the car, and she said, "Why did you tell her all that?" I said, "Well, did you stay sober?" She said, "Yeah." I did, and I said, and I did too, let's go. We spent the worst time when somebody didn't want to stop drinking. Because there's one thing that an alcoholic, practicing alcoholic, has one dignity left, and that is to pick their own sobriety date. And I truly believe that it takes what it takes. But going back to Kathy calling, I have a sponsoree that calls me every day or every 2 days. My husband has got cancer, and it's a real tough time right now, but I'm trying to be positive and, you know, trust that God will heal him. through the hands that God gave the medical hands to do the chemo and radiation. The hardest thing is to see him. He is such an active person. To see him where he can only be up 15 minutes and have to lay down and sleep for 45 minutes. And this man was up. He's a doer. He's one of the kind of guys and people in the world that make things happen because he's constantly doing. And I really admired that in him. And I'll sure be glad to be able to see that again. That's just happened recently, and about 3 months ago we found out that he had lung cancer. It's the non-cell lung cancer. So see, that's a real thing. You know, that's a real hard thing. You can lose it. It doesn't matter how long you've been in recovery. Hard things happen. Tough things happen. And you just have to walk through them. It's just what it is. Because drinking ain't going to change my husband. I want Jerry. And I want to have sober time, you know? And then another earlier, like, 7 years ago, my father died. We really, you know, got close after recovery, and he started trusting me again and saw the stability and really started admiring what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for me. And he could come to the anniversaries every time, and then it got where he would come every 5 years, because that's the thing, he wanted to come every year. I don't care. I said, well, I'm just saying, if you would rather come like on a 5 years, 10 years, 50, that'd be all right. Those are like real marking stones, I guess you say, to me anyway. But not to say that everybody isn't important, but I don't know if that makes sense to anybody, but, but he was on a motorcycle, and we lived on motorcycles. I grew up on a motorcycle. I think I was on his back in his motorcycle all the time I could walk. And 7 years ago, he was killed on a motorcycle. This was a person that was an avid biker, knew how to handle himself. And he just didn't react right, and it threw him over the handlebars and broke his neck and brainstem. And he was revived by the life flight that came and got him, but he was already dead. He was on those machines. And I thought I was absolutely gonna die. But I didn't. You people carried me. And I'm sharing this because it's just tough things happen in sobriety, tough things happen to everybody that walks on this earth. In AA, out of AA, it's just the way it is. And we have to, but the good thing about it is we have this program to keep us in balance, to keep in touch and look at things differently than I ever saw it before. And then I lost my mother. And I just really thought I was going to die because my mother was never around much because she was an alcoholic. She was borderline personality defect or whatever they call it and psychotic. So many times I didn't know what, if she was telling me the truth or not. And it got to the point I just had to let go because I couldn't. function. I had a job, I had responsibilities, and I just couldn't get my car and go down there every time. And the last year, it was just, he was calling me constantly. And I just began to really, you know, like, the people that come in and out of the program, you know, you just get to the point where, you know, I don't know whether to believe it or not. And I began that way with my mother. And I got a call from my sister, and she said, Joan, you need to come up here, I think, and this is it. This mother's not fake, and she, I don't think she's going to make it. And she died of renal poisoning, and with a blood spill, and all the things that you had said were true. But she had lied to me so many times. But I know that it was, sometimes you have that self-preservation, you know, because I had to be comfortable and live, and I couldn't have that keep draining me, and I always felt like I should fix it, but I couldn't all my life. So those are the really hardest things that have been in recovery. But by the grace of God, these 12 steps work. And, you know, there's so many things that we can do, and the big book talks about, I'm a true believer that in the big book, it has a lot of things that I agree with. If it's in that book, and if it's what Dr. Bob and Bill W. said, this is how it is, and this is what it takes, I believe it. Because I have seen it, and I trust them as the founders of our program, and to be able to have this, and I don't believe that with things in the big book, if it wasn't necessary for our survival. So that's how I feel, and I think of all the prayers that are in there, the St. Francis prayer, I love that prayer. It gives us so many things to do, and, you know, get out of ourselves and work with others. If you want to have security in your recovery, I'm telling you that 12-step work is one of the most insurance you will have in your recovery. There's always somebody out there that needs help. Reach out the hand and talk to them. Tell them who you are. Even if you think you don't have anything to say, you do. You haven't had a drink that day. So, you know, shake their hand and say, we are so glad to have you. We need you and we love you. It might be the most important thing that person has heard in a long time, and it sure was for me, and I really needed to hear those words, and I turn my life and live over to the care of God, and I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. Do I do it perfectly? No. Do I put my best foot forward? Yeah. I do. But I'm going to fall. And you know what? I don't want to be put on a pedestal because I will falter. I'm not God. The only perfect person in this universe, or outside this universe, wherever God may be, I just know that I am it and that I trust Him. And that He will carry me through whatever rocks and roads I have to go through. I heard somebody speak one time and they said, you know, some people find God, they go down and they've been brought up in the church and they go down the smooth road, no debris, and your life goes on and they find God. And then there's that this person like me, the alcoholic, I had to go through the devil, the debris, the trees, the forest, everything you can imagine. But in the end, I was on my knees, asking God to remove this desire to drink and accept that I am an alcoholic and that I cannot take the first drink. And so, it doesn't matter how one gets there as long as you do, because it does say, Bill W. and Dr. Bob say, you know, it takes a spiritual awakening to really have, recovery. You would be rocketed into a new dimension. Talks about that. Tells us all about those things and that there's hope and all of that. And maybe you haven't experienced it yet, but it will come as long as you keep coming back. And even if you have time, don't give up. Because don't give up before the miracle happens. Anyway, thank y'all for letting me share, and I didn't want to take up so much time, and God bless you all in your recovery where you are, and I hope you will find more and more peace. Thank you.